The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Now, before the break, we were talking with Pat Leahy, the political editor of the Irish Times, about international protection here and how attitudes are changing, perhaps hardening. But the global migration crisis generally is reaching a tipping point, threatening displaced populations worldwide. As nations struggle with the challenges, a cohesive global strategy for refugee movement is more crucial than ever. And experts are gathering at the World Bar Conference in Dublin today to explore solutions. With me in studio, my next guest, with her extensive background in international law and human rights, is one of those experts, Professor Gillian Triggs, former Assistant Secretary General and Assistant High Commissioner for Protection at the Office of the UNHCR. Good morning and welcome. Great title.
Thank you very much. I'm really delighted to be here in Ireland.
Now we are looking at our own local crisis, but you're saying it's not just you guys, it's everywhere.
Well, that's true. And I am here, of course, to talk about the United Nations work for 120,000 refugees on the move, nearly 400 million people actually displaced globally. So I do want, of course, to emphasize and put things in perspective. But I also have to understand that everything is local, ultimately. And I was very honored to be here about 18 months ago and seeing Ireland's welcome to largely Ukrainians, some from other parts of the world in North Africa, coming through the various reception centres, an atmosphere of can-do that they could provide protection, they could support. And I've seen in those 18 months coming back now how that has changed. I think my message is to say, yes, everything is local. Of course, we're going to respond because we've got housing problems. We can't get hospital appointments, etc. We understand in the UN that it becomes local, but there is a global environment when we have unprecedented numbers of people on the move, largely because of conflict. And we're urging an effort to think about root causes, stabilizing populations where they are, investing in countries, and to stop the stream of people looking for protection internationally.
The difficulty, I suppose, is that normally, if you've got a conflict in a particular country, that most people, if they flee just across the border. That's and right. It happened to many people in Ukraine. They fled across the border to Poland, where they remained. And, you know, they were culturally similar and so on. And the same might apply to other conflicts, be it in the Middle East or in Africa. You'd imagine that it would be more logical to stay local.
Well, the truth is that they do. And numerically, overwhelmingly, people are displaced in their own country for a start, and then they will seek protection across national boundaries to their neighbourhood, their local countries, where there's usually some level of welcome because they understand the politics, they understand how they, for example, in Sudan, people have moved to Chad, to Ethiopia, seeking protection, and they get that protection. A relatively tiny number of those hundreds of millions ever cross the Mediterranean or come into the Europe and the United Kingdom, yep, and then to Ireland. It's a tiny number. Relatively, it's small. But I quite take the point that when you're in Ireland and you've got people camping on your canals, you've got people in poor conditions with no real solutions, I can understand this becomes a domestic political problem. But what we are trying to do within the UN is to say, let us work together, not unilaterally. The tit-for-tat legislation, the disputes between countries about returns, that's part of the political issue. But what we really need to do is to look at the whole of journey approach and understand why people are moving, why they're not staying in their local areas, how we stabilize them with jobs, healthcare and education.
So you think the solution is rather to keep them as close to home as possible, to address conflict, to address the reasons for people moving? Sometimes it's a natural disaster. It can be flooding. It can be global warming bringing on all sorts of things. It can be earthquakes that force people to move. Some of those things you can't address, you can't predict, no. But other things.
Well, I think what we can respond to disasters, and you usually get very positive responses in doing so. And after disasters, people typically go back to their own homes.
Yeah.
But when you have conflict and civil war, and it's extremely difficult to do that. And one of the things that I think we're observing now is that many conflicts are long term. They're unprecedentedly long periods of time, and they seem to be irresolvable. Syria for the last 12, 13 years, Afghanistan more than 40 years. That's in recent history. Myanmar, a military coup and a genocidal destruction of the Rohingya people, 5-6 years. The political instability in the Sahel, the role of non-government armed groups, the Boko Haram abducting schoolchildren, it's a constant story. These are conflicts which we are finding have not been able to be resolved. Sudan was is an example with a peace agreement, and yet now we have a bloody civil war. Ethiopia was almost a poster example of peace, and the president got the Nobel Peace Prize. Within months, there's a war in Tigray, and again, hundreds of thousands of displaced people in utter misery yet again.
So who are the actors who can change things? I mean, if you've got a war, unexpected perhaps in Ethiopia, I mean, are there no watchdogs who are looking for these conflicts and trying to put out the fires before they erupt? Now, we can look at ourselves. Who predicted what happened in Ukraine with Putin? So when you have bad actors who are going to do certain things, but, you know, within the African continent, we depend on what body will keep an eye on those conflicts and try to put them out?
Well, that's right. I mean, there's a lot of research of what the indicators of conflict are going to be, what the predictors are. And it's usually poverty, ethnic tensions, land disputes, lack of employment, but very often ethnically related, or where you have extreme groups that attack at borders. I remember making perhaps a rather naive comment in Niger. Who were these armed groups that were attacking villages and burning down villages and macheting young people? Were they organised? Did they have a uniform? And the answer I got was, no, they're 20-year-olds with a motorbike and a Kalashnikov rifle. And then they simply, they're completely out of control. And even governments that are acting in good faith, often with support from European countries, they fail because they can't control this level of violence. Now, that's just one example in many others. But I think to answer your question, yes, you can predict the indicators of likely conflict, but extremely hard to control it, partly because the United Nations system is failing with a veto used to prevent Security Council acting. Peacekeeping forces are not so popular anymore. The French, as you know, have withdrawn from Africa. The UN is withdrawing some of its peacekeeping forces, but others, perhaps Haiti, would be an example where they go in. But it's not the solution that we thought it was going to be. When I was a young law student in the 60s, the UN Charter was the way forward. And the use of the veto and the misuse has really impeded those efforts.
Now, part of the problem, I suppose, is that migrants can flow from very populous parts of the world, and they arrive in places like Ireland, which are actually very low in population. I mean, we have across the island 5 and a bit million people here and somewhat less than 2 million people in Northern Ireland. So you're looking at less than 8 million people, certainly on this island. And yet we have half the landmass that the neighbouring island has. So we are underpopulated. There's no question about it. So then you have the arrival of people from different parts of the world, you know, from places that we would not have expected migration before. And the effect on the indigenous population can be quite marked. Mm-hmm. You know, when you see so many people who don't come from here living in suburbs of Dublin, for example,
that's right.
And it almost engenders a racism. It
I'm
should not,
it
but it does.
We have to be realistic that it does. But it's often linked to other elements, lack of housing, lack of ability to get work, children overcrowded in schools. That then prompts or stimulates some underlying reluctance. Sometimes it's racist. Sometimes it's sort of cultural uncomfortableness. These things can be managed. And in a relatively smaller country and a wealthy country like Ireland, I think it can be managed. And I think that's why...
Should there be any limits at all on the numbers coming in? I mean, everyone who comes in should be assessed as to their deserving of asylum or otherwise. That's fine. But with so many catastrophes across the world and so many people on the move, is there no limit that could be put in place? Because although we've had Vikings and Normans and all the rest coming in and changing the nature of our DNA and our populations, there would be some resistance to change at a very rapid rate.
I think that's the problem. It's the sheer volume. And I like to remind perhaps the older listeners, that in 1951, when the Refugee Convention was agreed by 26 countries, including Ireland or the United Kingdom as well, there were about 2 million people displaced, partly as a leftover of the First World War and then the Second World War. 2 million. Now we have something like 120 million people who are now seen as refugees and asylum seekers. And that's not counting the close to 400 million who are also migrants.
Yeah.
We at the UN, of course, make a very significant difference between a migrant and a refugee. Whether you allow a migrant into the country is a matter of sovereign jurisdiction of the government. They make their own minds about migration.
And they can have a visa process.
And they have proper legal processes, and they can manage it entirely as they choose because it's a sovereign matter. But refugees are a different question because they have international legal status, because Ireland has accepted the conditions, the rights that refugees have. Now, we come to your question, but the numbers are so big. You know, when we were dealing with a small number, a few hundred, a few thousand even, we felt we could cope with it. But when you're getting what are, for a small, relatively small population in Ireland, numbers that are seen as large, then that creates a political problem. Now, politicians can manage that. But, and I'm not speaking of Ireland, but in many parts of the world, politicians act in bad faith. They mix up migration with refugees. They make all sorts of assertions, highly negative, and that in turn engenders an even more negative and a more difficult environment for refugees who need that humanitarian support.
Now, you referenced what happened when the Ukrainians arrived on foot of the war, and the Ukrainians are, and we have to state it, they're all white. And that is a plain fact, and perhaps the welcome on the mat was warmer because of that very fact. But a lot of people won't ever confess to that.
No, because nobody wants to be accused of being racist. And nor do we really want to use that word. And I shouldn't say we in the UN. I did actually retire in January. But I know that the High Commissioner and the Secretary General did not want to use that word. But in the end, we did have to use that word because some people were simply acting in racially motivated ways. For example, at the same time as 8.3 million people moved across the border, as you rightly say, from Ukraine to Poland and then into Europe, 5.3 million, I understand, have taken advantage of the directive, which enables them to work, to get their children to school, etc. A remarkable, unprecedented act of hospitality by the Europeans. And it's worked very well. But at the same time, you might recall, there was a reluctance to allow in people who were from China, from Bangladesh, from India, from the Sahel, from Sudan or Ethiopia. And I'm afraid there was only one reason for that, which is essentially racist.
Racist. So in not allowing people from other areas of conflict, it is fundamentally racist. The other thing, I suppose, is there is that kind of cultural thing that Europeans are Europeans and they share values and so on. And that's why we welcome Europeans, but maybe not people who come from a very different cultural background. I mean, is that racist when that happens? Or is that simply we feel more comfortable with people who are like us?
Well, again, I think we should be careful about the use of the word racist. Some people really are blatantly racist. There's no doubt about that. But I believe that that's a relatively small number. Most are prepared to give it a go. But to give it a go, to get the children into school, et cetera, you have to have a tolerance and you have to have a plan and you have to have political leadership that will emphasize, one, the humanitarian responsibility to people fleeing violence. And most of the, overwhelmingly, people are fleeing violence and persecution of the most extreme kind. You need that political support. Over time, it can be managed, but you need a lot of support and understanding. And unfortunately, when the numbers come in a circumstance where housing is an issue, where overcrowding in schools is an issue, access to healthcare is an issue, then you get a combination of factors that then inflames into something that looks like racism.
I presume also the speed at which it happens has an impact. I mean, if you've got a trickle coming in, absorb, trickle, absorb, trickle, absorb, that's fine.
That's right.
If suddenly you have, as we have, 90 tents along the Grand Canal this morning, and we had a tented village around the IPAS Centre and so on and so forth, it becomes very obvious. And it's real as well, because I presume these are new arrivals across the border who are coming, not people who've been sorted out by the government.
That's right. So well, what I saw, 18 months or so ago was people actually moving across Ireland.
Yeah.
And I imagine most of those have found their place. And we find within the UN refugee system that local communities wrap around refugees very quickly. You can have the global political environment, you can have the political questions, particularly in times of election, which can be quite difficult and tense. But once you've got people in a local village where the children are in school, mums shopping, and dad's got a job of some kind, then you find local communities, understand them better, understand their story and want to help. That's a very common pattern, but you've got to get past the politics.
Now, you mentioned that it's local, or and in every country it is local, and we've seen what happened in the pre-local election situation in Britain and how the Rwanda card was played and played against us some of the time. The Rwanda policy itself, I mean, when I heard it, I just thought it was an April Fool joke. I just, like, people come from, it doesn't matter what part of the world, but you're going to Rwanda to be processed. Come on. It just was mad.
Well, we were, of course, shocked by this in the UN Refugee Agency. We provided an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief, to say why this was unworkable. Firstly, it was a blatant example of shifting the responsibility for refugees, the humanitarian responsibility and legal responsibility, to a relatively poorer country without the relevant safeguards for human rights. It was an extraordinary thing to do. And as we know, so far, not a single plane has taken off with anybody to go to Rwanda. Now, switching gear, there is nothing wrong with countries cooperating regionally or bilaterally, but preferably regionally, to share responsibility, which is really what the Global Compact on Refugees does. And up to a point, not perfect, is the EU Pact, which, as you will know, has recently been agreed.
Yeah, but won't really be operating for another couple of years.
No. But we have to work in the UN. We have to work in a political reality. We understand these things take time. It's not a long way from perfect, but we do feel that that's a positive step. So countries could work together to say, let's share this, let's keep people in the region, let's make sure that they've got opportunities, let's make sure that they've got proper legal processes, proper safeguards for human rights. We can do this together. So we're not in the UN Refugee Agency objecting to this in principle, but what we are saying is to have a wealthy country with a highly developed legal system, like Ireland, to shift that burden to a country that was emerging from genocide, has its own problems on the border with the Democratic Republic of the Congo, the courts admitting that the safeguards were not in place, that is really not an acceptable solution. Quite apart from that, it's costing a lot of money and not effective as a deterrent.
They're just taking the legal principle that the British government can declare Rwanda safe. Irrespective of conditions on the ground, we declare Rwanda is safe.
Well, and we find that a lot. Countries, sovereign nations, will declare that they are acting in compliance with international law. Full stop. They don't explain why. And ultimately, and that is why we're here in Dublin today with the bar, the independent bar, to say in the end, these questions must be ones for the court. And we find over and over again, whether it's in Ireland, in the United Kingdom, in the United States, Europe, Australia, Canada, those courts almost invariably come up with an international law solution to say these are not deportation of people to a developing country without proper systems in place is not consistent with international law.
On that note, Gillian Triggs, thank you very much for joining us in the studio today, and I hope the discussions today are productive.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure.
Thank you very much.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.